This is Neijing Now, prioritizing well-being. Neijing is the concept that taking medicines for an illness is like digging a well when thirsty. Neijing Now, placing and taking responsibility for the health of the individual and the planet. From molecular biology to global ecology, from political, social, economics to psychology and spirituality. Neijing Now, demystifying medicine, empowering host resistance. We can be found on the web at neijingnow.org. neijingnow.org. I'm Dr. Jayashree Chandler, and I welcome you to another edition of Exploring Neijing Now. As we continue our series on sleep, we will turn our attention to sleep deprivation, its social and medical consequences, its human and cultural aspects, and its use as a method of torture.
Their perception about sleep comes from their perception of what darkness is like. Sleep is rather a group affair rather than a lonely experience.
I mean, we are having a zombie generation.
Finally, a woman who works the night shift in a call center will share with us how her life and health changed.
I remember the same nightmare of being tired.
The peer-reviewed journal Alternative Therapies reports on a study by the Commonwealth Fund, a private foundation funding independent research and advocating for healthcare quality and accessibility. They report that 90% of Americans inquiring about purchasing private health insurance policies remain uninsured due to unaffordable plans or denial of coverage. Half of individuals with private plans paid more than $3,000 per year, while that amount was only paid by 20% of people covered through their employer. Almost half of people with private insurance pay around 10% of their income towards health insurance. The Democratic sweep of the midterm elections in the United States has caused a fall in stock prices for pharmaceutical companies and managed health care companies. The Democratic-led Congress may be considering legislation aimed at regulating the escalating costs of drugs and health care. The American Stock Exchange Index for pharmaceutical companies fell 3.4% in the days immediately following the election. The drop in share prices for managed healthcare providers ranged from 2% to 10%. November 14th is the World Health Organization declared World Diabetes Day. This year, WHO is focusing its efforts on getting proper diabetes care to disadvantaged communities and vulnerable groups worldwide, particularly rural migrants to urban areas. The WHO suspects 180 million people worldwide to have diabetes, with that number expected to double by 2030. An estimated 1.1 million people died of diabetes in 2005. Most diabetes deaths occur in low- and middle-income countries. Half of diabetes deaths occur in those under the age of 70, and half of diabetes deaths are in women. Without urgent action, the WHO estimates a 50% increase in diabetes deaths in the next 10 years, with an 80% increase in upper- and middle-income countries. Recently, 22 countries signed on to the Global Patient Safety Challenge, designed to increase patient safety within the healthcare systems of the world. About 1.5 million people worldwide are ill at any given moment due to infections acquired in hospitals. In developed countries, about 5 to 10% of patients are affected. In developing nations, closer to 25%. The single most effective intervention to preventing the transmission of infections in the healthcare setting is for clinicians to wash their hands prior to contacting a patient. There are 5 basic elements to the Global Patient Safety Challenge initiative: increasing the safety of blood supplies, injection and immunization safety, safe clinical and surgical procedures, safe water and sanitation in healthcare facilities, and of course, good hand hygiene. The United Nations reports that the toilet and the latrine are the most underutilized public health tools used to combat disease in the developing world. 2 million children die every year due to diarrhea and other illnesses caused by contaminated water and lack of sanitation. The problem is that more than a third of the world's population doesn't have a place to go to the bathroom. At the same time, 1 billion people all over the world get their drinking water from sources that are polluted with human and animal excrement. At any given moment, half the population of the developing world suffer from diseases caused by contaminated water, and half the hospital beds have patients with cholera, typhoid, trachoma, intestinal parasites, and other diarrheal illnesses. The report estimates it would cost $10 billion to give access to clean water to half of those now without. This, they say, is less than half what the developed world currently spends on bottled water. In general, governments of developing nations are spending at least 10 to 50 times as much on their military budgets as on their water and sanitation budgets. Aid from rich countries for water and sanitation has also fallen from 8% to 5% of overall development aid. Most of the innovative attempts to provide affordable access to toilets and latrines have occurred in Pakistan, Bangladesh, and India. Finally, November 16th is the Great American Smokeout, announced by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. This year is the 30th anniversary and is sponsored by the American Cancer Society to encourage smokers in the United States to quit. Smokers worldwide may take motivation from the day and make efforts to quitting as well. For those interested, there are telephone quit lines throughout the United States that offer assistance and resources to help one quit smoking. These are toll-free at 1-800-QUIT-NOW. That's 1-800-784-8669. Information on how to quit can also be obtained from the website at www.smokefree.gov, smokefree.gov. You can find the link at our website, www.neijingnow.org, neijingnow.org. More than half the adult population of the United States is carrying a substantial sleep debt. Sleep debt is the difference between the hours of sleep a person needs for optimal physical, emotional, mental well-being and the number of hours the person actually gets. Before the invention of the electric light in 1879 by Thomas Edison, most people slept 10 hours a night. As recently as the 1960s, Americans slept an average of 9 hours per night. Today, the average is less than 7 hours, with one-third of Americans getting 6 hours of sleep or less each night. Sleep deprivation may be difficult to define in terms of hours. Some people swear they feel completely well-rested with 3 to 5 hours of sleep per night, and others, like myself, cannot do without 8. We probably need to speak in terms of averages over large groups of people and in terms of ability to complete tasks effectively. Some studies have shown that 7 hours of sleep per night over 1 week resulted in slower reaction times and slower problem solving. With 5 hours of sleep per night over 1 week, the accuracy of these tasks also begins to decline. Even with the quote-unquote minimal sleep deprivation of 7 hours per night for 1 week, the ability to carry out tasks that require focusing on several tasks simultaneously, like driving, your ability to carry out these tasks diminishes. In driving simulations, for example, accidents increase progressively as total sleep duration is decreased to 7 hours per night for 1 week, 5 hours per night for 1 week, and it's worse at 3 hours per night for 1 week. In the same simulations, 3 hours total sleep duration was associated with loss of ability to simultaneously appreciate the visual cues in your direct line of vision and your peripheral vision. In tasks requiring judgment, increasing risky behaviors emerge as the total sleep duration is limited to 5 hours per night. One theory of why sleep deprivation causes these impairments is that there may be something called microsleep. These are brief episodes, meaning like several seconds, of sleep-type brainwaves that break through normal waking brainwaves. Their frequency increases as sleep deprivation increases. In some studies in which brainwaves are recorded simultaneously, microsleep seems to impair the continuity of cognitive function, the function of your conscious brain. These microsleep episodes occur just before there's a performance failure. Special types of brain scans, called glucose PET scans, have shown that people deprived of sleep for 24 hours have a decrease in metabolism in certain parts of their brains, namely the prefrontal and parietal areas. These areas are most important for judgment, impulse control, attention, and visual association. In sleep deprivation, these areas have lower metabolism compared to the areas that are controlling your sensory and motor control. And the sensory and motor areas are what receive and act upon environmental inputs, environmental clues. So it seems that areas of the brain most responsible for higher order functioning are to some degree less functional during sleep-deprived waking activity. So in essence, the parts of the brain that are important for attention and processing your visual cues and sensory cues, those areas are less functional while you're awake, if you've been sleep deprived, than the areas necessary for acting upon those clues. There's a difference in how these areas behave and respond. This may be what leads to a higher incidence of accidents and misjudgments and misactions. Sleep deprivation is a relative concept. Small amounts of sleep loss, for example, 1 hour per night over many nights, have subtle cognitive costs. And these can go unrecognized by the individual experiencing the sleep loss. More severe restrictions of sleep for a week leads to profound cognitive deficits, similar to those seen in some stroke patients, which also appear to go unrecognized by the individual. One can even see brief psychotic episodes, but these are not permanent psychological defects. Of course, irritability and disorientation can occur along with lack of attentiveness. And if the sleep deprivation is severe, a person can suffer from seizures and tremors. Dr. Sanjay Manchanda is a senior consultant and founder of the Department of Sleep Medicine at Ganga Ram Hospital in New Delhi. I spoke to him over the phone about the consequences of sleep deprivation.
Now, as far as the importance of sleep deprivation is concerned, there are a few important things that I'll tell you. That number one is that 33% of all roadside and industrial accidents are because of sleep deprivation.
That's quite significant.
Because you just need a small snooze at the wheel. So they say that a snooze at the wheel may last for eternity. So some of the major disasters in the history that have taken place in the recent times, they have been because of sleep deprivation of the people at work, like Bhopal gas tragedy, like Chernobyl nuclear power plant disaster that occurred in Ukraine, with the 3.2 million people affected in that, the space shuttle disaster as well. And apart from that, there was this cruise ship, Star Cruise Ship Princess, which had to be grounded with more than 2,000 people on board in 1995 because the person who was manning it, he, you know, had slept on the wheel and there was a, you know, disaster and the tank oil leaked somewhere and they had to, you know, do this thing. So there are major disasters, and importance is that we do not know when they are occurring.
I hadn't heard about this, that sleep deprivation was a factor in the Union Carbide gas disaster in Bhopal.
Basically, there is some evidence on the net, you can pick it up, that there was some problem with the last worker who couldn't do certain things which should have been done. And you can say it might be very interesting to know that a highly sleep-deprived person can move from fully awake phase to deep sleep in less than 10 seconds.
Wow.
Yeah, and it has also been seen that if a person is chronically sleep-deprived, his performance is worse than daily alcoholic. You know, every facet is basically dented, his abiding power, his concentration power, his working capacity, his cognition problems over a period of time if the person is getting chronically sleep deprived. Another important aspect is with the advent of artificial light in the past 100 years, what has happened is that we have been able to prolong our days at our will. What has happened is that as a society, in the last 100 years, we have become a sleep-deprived society, and we are sleeping at least 2 hours less than our predecessors were.
Every day.
Every day. So the cumulative sleep loss of the society has increased tremendously. And apart from that, with late night activities, parties, and late night jobs, and shift working.
There's also, I think, a societal, cultural expectation that every individual has to be so much more productive.
Well, this competitiveness is something which is a part and parcel of the society. But the thing is, as far as sleep deprivation is concerned, yes, you can attribute some amount of that to that also, increased number of hours, putting in more labor, and more that you have to achieve this kind of a target in a much lesser time. So these things might be a contributory factor, but by and large, since the advent of the artificial light, yes, we have started becoming sleep deprived more because we can prolong our days tremendously and for all times to come for that matter.
What would you say the physiological effects? You've kind of spoken about the cognitive effects, reaction time, you know, increased risk of mistakes.
Yes,
but
the clouding of the brain is there. Your judgmental qualities go down. Because the thing is, everything is related to the mental and the physical rest. If you are being deprived of it regularly over a period of time, and you can attribute them virtually to everything, to strokes, to heart attacks, to sudden cardiac death, to death during sleep, to there are so many things, and daytime sleepiness, all these things, they increase over a period of time.
Are there effects on the immune system or effects on the endocrine system?
Yes. And these people who have lesser amount of sleep, they become more prone to infections. Some evidence of that.
Right.
So not conclusive, but there's some evidence.
Would you say there are things that, as a society, we can prioritize to improve the quality and quantity of sleep we're getting as a community?
We should, because the thing is, this is one area which has totally neglected. If you look at the history of mankind, in a 5,000 years of written history of mankind, it is only in last 30 years that you actually started studying this part of life. In seeing everything in the daytime, their seeds might be sown during the sleeping period, which we have not identified. And, well, we must be at least aware of the thing. So if you do not have the primary knowledge, what happens is that it is something which is either neglected or tried to be solved with a simple kind of a sleeping pill or something, so which is not a correct kind of an attitude.
So I was thinking along the lines of, for example, office start times or school start times.
In today's world, I think that most of these things cannot be helped too much, because when the factories are running, the round-the-clock jobs are going on, somebody has to do a night work. Science says what is invented cannot be disinvented.
Generally, we think of people in the West as being significantly sleep deprived, but what I'm hearing is that even people here in India or in developing nations are also becoming sleep deprived.
Absolutely. There's a huge percentage of people who are sleep deprived, and they will be, and in future years they further will be, because you can't take the clock back.
The percentage of people that are chronically sleep deprived is increasing in relation to kind of the industrialization and economic growth of the country.
Yes, adding on to it. Yes, that is definitely adding on to the thing.
Uh-huh. And have you noted a difference between like the urban population and rural populations?
Not really much, because we do not have those kind of statistics with us.
Thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Bye. Din din tha kat tit tit kit dha gege tit gadi gen dha 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 din ta din ta kat dha gein tit ta ge tit gege nana gege trir dha gen dha gen dha gein tit ta ge tit gege nana gege trir dha gen dha gen dha gein tit ta ge tit gege nana gege trir dha gen dha gen
Dr. Indra Ramarao is a professor of sociology and director of the International Center at the University of Mysore. She has a PhD in sociology from the University of Mysore, and her areas of research interest are in gender and forest communities. I spoke to her over the phone about the societal implications of sleep deprivation.
I wanted to know, from a sociologist's perspective, how different cultures prioritize sleep.
Culture, to me as a sociologist, is just a way of life. I would consider, in one sense, sleep to be a biological activity. The priority that the institution or an individual attaches to sleep itself is determined by the way that society lives. For example, it depends on the work pattern. In societies, you know, where the nature of economic activity is simple, when, you know, there is a system of exchange of goods, or even today in many societies in simple forest communities, for example, with which I have been working for a long time, you know, there is this culture of sharing and giving. And even though there is no wealth as such in many of these cultures, but because the limited desires they have, the limited exposures that they have, and the fact that given the culture of sharing and giving, they are not really worried about the next meal or what tomorrow would bring them, they can take life little easily than those, you know, especially people who live in cities, people whose work cultures have created so much stress. Yeah, the pattern of living, I would put it that way, you know, our lifestyles, our work, our economic roles, and the kind of relationships we have in our communities and neighborhoods, these are factors that would ultimately determine how much of priority we give to sleep. You see, in an individual's life or in the life of a family, a certain kind of a feeling of security is also very important. And where, you know, we have primary relationships, face-to-face relationships, a closeness in a physical sense, as well as in a social sense, then it is possible that individuals and families can be more at peace and can feel more secure than those individuals and communities where secondary relations dominate.
So this feeling of peace and security then is determining how well one is sleeping.
That is my opinion.
How would you say a community's sleep deficit affects that society?
Because of the stress inbuilt into the way, you know, we form relationships, or the way we try to safeguard the relationships that are already formed, you know, starting from the smallest institution, that is the family, and then going back, going outside the family, you see that when you sleep well, when your body has rested, when your mind has rested, it is also very likely, of course, there may always be some persons who do all this and yet, you know, are not very well adjusted. By and large, you know, when these needs are properly taken care of, social relationships between members of a family and between one family and other and in the neighborhood institutions is likely to be more cordial. But you take a neighborhood or a community, you know, where everybody is in a great hurry to do certain things or live up to the mirrored expectations that their jobs or their multiple roles have, then it is likely that, you know, the entire community's relationship structure itself gets affected.
Adversely affected, one would
say. Adversely affected. Because, you know, you see, even now there may be physical proximity now in many of these apartment blocks and huge buildings. But then the social networking and relationships are getting adversely affected because of the stresses that are part of our lives now.
How can we change our structure or our priorities so that we are not so sleep deprived and not so stressed?
Yeah, the first thing that I would you know, say is that, see, we have to accept the fact that whether we like it or not, times have changed and we have to keep in tune with the changing times, number one. Second thing that I would say is, in our role play in social institutions, let's take the family itself for example, we'll have to make a large number of changes, you know, because we have to accept the fact that the structure of institutions is bound to change. In compromising sleep, I think the quality of our existence itself gets affected. One thing is certain, that sleep is very essential to keep our bodies and minds healthy. Only when the bodies and minds of people are healthy, you know, you can create a society that is healthy. the needs of different societies, the compulsions of different societies, the lifestyles of different societies are different. It's up to us to decide what activities in our life in the course of a day must be given some time by us. And to me, sleep is one such activity. The media is full of stories and reports of people who are not able to live like the normal life. I don't know what that normal life, whatever it means, because as society changes, you know, our concept of normality, happiness, peace, tranquility, everything should change. But ultimately, you know, you choose your life. You choose to be busy, you choose a lifestyle, you choose your job, whatever, whatever, because it brings in many advantages. While we choose what we want to do, we have to see that, you know, we don't deny ourselves certain basic human needs, of which sleep is one.
Yeah. Very well said. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your thoughts.
Okay.
Dr. Vinita Menon has a PhD in anthropology from York University. She is a professor and the Dean of Faculty of Humanities and Chairperson of the Board of Studies in Anthropology at Kannur University in Kerala. I spoke to her over the phone about how human beings' perspectives on sleep are shaped. One can hear the pair of lovebirds in her home cawing in the background.
As an anthropologist, I wanted to know how you think different cultures value sleep.
Different communities, their perception about sleep comes from their perception of what darkness is like. Day and night are opposed to each other, and when darkness falls, how cultures have been able to cope with the darkness. For example, if you have a fear and there is no light, you can imagine the indigenous communities, basically the forest-raised communities, their group life and rituals of these small-scale communities are known to be greater than in complex societies. Especially most of them related to group behavior and rituals happening at night time. After the invention of fire, they huddle around the fire and for warmth as well as for keeping away fears about the evil spirits and all that. Sleep is rather a group affair rather than a lonely experience where people have their own separate quarters. They decide on their sleep, when they should sleep and when they should wake up. So this kind of organization about when people should sleep and when they should be awake has a lot to do with the facilities that people have as well. And the perception about health, or as one would say, sleep deprivation. If you're thinking about Ayurveda in Kerala, they say that human body needs to have proper rest. And if a person is not properly sleeping, then they have particular herbal therapies where they make these people sleep. And mental health is supposed to be closely related to people's sleep pattern. And sleep deprivation, then you imagine that the person may develop mental problems or depression. So that is one of the perceptions that people used to hold to. And the more you are exposed to these kinds of perceptions about health from a scientific point of view, whether it's in the indigenous medical system or in Western biomedical system, sleep and a person's health are related. The more westernized or the more knowledgeable you are about these matters, or with literacy you come to read more, I think people's perception about sleep also undergoes transformation. And then you have a notion about what your health is going to be like if you don't have so many hours of sleep, full sleep.
Basically, as people become more literate and more exposed to the scientific concepts of health and its relationship with sleep, then they actually start to perceive sleep differently and to perceive their health differently. Is that correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also with activities being on the increase, people extend their daytime activities, stretches into the night, or socialization patterns become very different. Like you go for movies in the evenings, or you have hangouts. People sit together and they have their entertainments, even second shows in the theaters. Uh-huh. People tend to keep late hours.
Do you think that that wasn't happening around the fire and around the campfire?
around the fire, the rituals perhaps were happening during nighttime. For example, we have a community called the Kanikar in Kerala. Their healing rituals and their rituals heralding a new season for festivities and all that, or propitiating the ancestors. They used to have a ceremony called Chatter. So it's around the fire. They have these performances with music and musical instruments. So they will be singing to the ancestors, praising the gods and all that. It's an all-time activity.
But even you can say outside of indigenous groups, you even just have these all-night pujas and things that even the middle upper class participate in, jagratas and all
that's
this.
That's true.
So
culture and its perceptions about what one's life should be like, or its relationship to nature, and how they perceive these kinds of influences, whether it's cosmology or ancestors or spirits, or how days and nights are being organized. So you have perceptions with regard to a person's lifestyle. For example, in Kerala, there is a folk belief which says that pregnant women should not sleep during the afternoons. So the afternoon siesta is not allowed. So if you don't want to put on weight, you should not sleep in the afternoon. You can lie down. But for elderly people, they expect elderly people to rest.
I see.
And even small babies in the kindergartens, you expect them to sleep or lie down. You compulsorily give rest to the body.
Do you think one's socioeconomic status within society or the hierarchies of society influences how people behave around sleep?
I think to some extent these have a relationship to the kind of knowledge one is exposed to. And one's perceptions also with regard to the groups that one is associated with. Let us say the BPOs or the call centers coming to India in a big way. So there are these youngsters who are keeping awake during the night. Western society is awake. It's daytime for the West, whereas here in the night, people keep awake to have business transactions or communications with people who are having daytime activities. And so you have a good number of people, even on the internet, because internet connectivity is better at night, keep awake at night to browse the net or to have interactions with people in chat groups or blogging or whatever. These are newer phenomena coming into India and the youngsters' life. You have the youngsters who are into outsourcing or the call centers or BPOs in India who have an extension of their activities into the night. And they're supposed to sleep during the daytime. India is awake during the daytime. And there are all these activities, whether you have to do banking or you have to take your children to school or to a religious center or do shopping. All these activities close down by night.
In some ways, you become kind of isolated and removed out of the rest of your community and
society. Even within a family, you can imagine one person having this nightlife and another person having ordinary daytime duties. Or if both of them have to be working during the night in a BPO, you can imagine that there has to be somebody to take the child to school or those kinds of activities that one is expected to do. One thing that you can safely assume is that when within a family, you have some people working during the night and some people who are working during daytime, even intergenerational problems seem to come up. The perceptions about how division of labor within the household should be organized remains more or less the same. So the children who come back, they expect their mothers to have cooked for them, or you know, when the mothers cook and keep the food out and the children don't come and eat it, they feel upset over it. So these kinds of activities we have seen in many families around. Yeah, I was saying that as a society, everybody don't feel the same. So there are these intergenerational problems and perceptions differ. So a consensus on the issue does not really come about. You have people who are working in the medical field speaking about how much sleep one should get, but not everybody accepts that because their priorities are on their activities.
There is not a recognition as a society as a whole that as a community we are being sleep deprived.
Yeah.
Or even that the importance of even individual sleep deprivation is something to be paid attention to.
Yeah. So I think unless people feel that sleep deprivation is a serious matter that is going to affect life, or you have to pay for it sometime sooner or later, then you don't want to do anything about it. Your cutting into your activities is considered to be more disastrous.
Or your income, or your profits.
Yes, exactly. Or your connections with people who matter.
Exactly. Basically, the global economy is running according to the time schedule of the Western world. However, I would add that the people in the Western world are also sleep depriving themselves quite significantly.
Yeah.
Yes.
But the reasons why they are so might be different.
Yes, exactly. The reasons might be different, but the fact of the sleep deprivation remains.
Yeah. For some people who realize that they are being sleep deprived, and perhaps they feel that they are having a lot of stress-related disorders, they still can't do anything about it.
In either culture, in either locality, they often feel that they are helpless in the situation.
Yes. Yes. Nobody is in a position to prioritize their sleep over other activities.
There is this idea of individual powerlessness in this realm, but I think collectively, if societies or communities were to prioritize sleep, then perhaps the whole structure would have to be shifted in order to meet that priority.
Yeah. How would one go about it? Do you have any ideas?
Well, I think it, in some ways it has to be first a raising of the consciousness and then a collective choice. You can also, even just based on the information, make individual choices. You know, you can choose to not take the call center job, or you can choose to work part-time and deal with a lower standard of living. I mean, there are...
For a place like Kerala, where unemployment rates are so high, even for very highly qualified people, call center jobs are one of the lucrative jobs that are coming by.
Well, and this exactly falls into the whole realm of development and employment and which direction a community wants to take. There's also something to be said for entrepreneurship and creativity and, you know, creating your own source of income. It may not be practical or realistic.
Yeah. In a place like Kerala, entrepreneurship is one of the least preferred things.
Well, it also takes courage. It takes courage and risk, you know.
So the risk-taking mentality is very, very low.
Exactly. So people prefer security over their sleep.
Yes. So what they are getting themselves into, I think they are not concerned at the moment. So there are so many different ways in which people have sleep deprivations. And sleep deprivation is not seen as a major priority, or health problems related to sleep are not really spoken of unless one is speaking about mental health. And even in a place like Kerala, where children are being crafted, children are crafted in some way to fulfill parents' expectations about them. The society as a whole is running after how well they are performing.
Some kind of status.
Yes.
Yes.
That is one of the crucial links to sleep deprivation. And unless we speak about these issues in a holistic frame, and as a society, you know, realize that we are really incurring certain costs in trying to be super performers.
And we are responsible for the choices and the values that we uphold. Thank you so much. You've been very, very helpful and very interesting conversation.
Thank you. That was an interesting conversation.
I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Yeah, me too. Din din da kata kata kita taka tete kata kita taka takita da kita 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 da.
Dr. Fatima Shahnaz is a human rights activist, writer, and journalist with a PhD in French literature from Sorbonne University in Paris. She is president of the India Peace Organization. She shared with me by phone how sleep deprivation has been used as a method of torture through history and the present times.
What is the history of the use of sleep deprivation as a method of torture?
Actually, it's a very ancient form of torture. And in the normal vocabulary, which is pre-9/11, we used to talk about Chinese torture. If you remember, it was a drip method.
it was keeping people awake with just water dripping over their heads or something. But now we have, with technology, we have evolved almost drastically regarding torture. We've got high-tech weaponry, you know, a sophisticated weapon. A very basic form of torture is sound, you know, noise. Oof. So we've heard, for instance, in Iraq that music is played all night, absolutely deafening, you know, music. This is supposed to be in the American, you know, in Abu Ghraib and prisons like that. Some of the forms of torture we've read about, making a prisoner sit on a stool with the legs cut off shorter in the front than in the back and hooded so that his balance is lost. And this can be excruciating if it goes on for 24 hours.
You definitely couldn't sleep in that position.
Oh, and of course you hear about prisons, for instance, where, you know, people bang on bars, the prison guards, to just simply as a form of torture, to disturb the patient, the prisoner. Noise is, I think, the number one. I think that another form of sleep deprivation, and again, if we're talking about torture, has been the use of hallucinogenics, you know, medication. And by the way, this drug issue is not simply torture or prisons. It could be in mental asylums.
So how effective of a tool do you think sleep deprivation is as a method of coercion?
I think it's one of the most extreme forms of torture that exists because it's psychological warfare. One of the most sophisticated forms of demoralizing or incapacitating the enemy is to affect their mind.
And so you're saying that depriving somebody of sleep directly affects their mind?
Yes. It's exponential. It's not. It's sort of just simply develops slowly, you know. It doesn't happen overnight. And you can do that with drugs, or you can also do it with noise pollution.
And do you think that we may have the torture of sleep deprivation happening in our societies outside of these so-called prisons and mental institutions and
torture
chambers, but even in corporations and things like that?
Now you're talking about industrialization. I think that this is an issue that is of tremendous concern for the young, for the future, because the young have gotten so addicted to a very sort of high-pressured lifestyle. Now, with the economy fluctuating, collapsing, and so on in many countries, what has happened is there are layoffs and there's downsizing. Downsizing means that you've got four people to do the job, let's say, or 15. So these people are working more hours. Sometimes they're working double jobs, double shifts. And sometimes in a single family, let's say, this is in the U.S., one family, husband, wife, double paychecks no longer suffice. So they've got to have double jobs. So you've got night jobs, day jobs. Instead of an 8-hour day, people are working 18-hour days. Now think of how that affects the family, how that affects women, the mothers. And then eventually you've got the social crisis.
Exactly.
It's an economic crisis. And that has happened throughout the 90s, and it's just getting worse. I'm talking of the developed world. I'm not even talking of the poor countries.
Exactly.
I'm talking of the United States and Europe. And over there, you are going to have a backlash in a social crisis where you're going to have generations of people sort of either dumbed down or bombed out of their heads. We're going to have disorders. They could be psychological. They could be emotional. Even functional disorders.
Sure, or addiction to speed, addiction to caffeine, addiction to...
Of course, all these are part of the disorders. And their children will have other disorders. So that's why they were talking of Generation XYZ mm-hmm. as being sort of zombies. I mean, we are having a zombie generation.
Because everybody's sleep deprived.
These are the things that go on in the sophisticated industrial world. By the way, all of these issues enter into the environmental problem.
Sure.
And in the Indian Constitution, there's a specific article. Article 21 of the Indian Constitution is the right to live. And this means the preservation, of course, of the habitat and access to pollution-free water and air. You've got the Air Pollution Act, Prevention and Control of Pollution Act of 1981, which controls not only air pollution, gas emissions of cars, but industrial processes and noise pollution. So all of these issues are already contained either in the Indian constitution or in the environmental laws. But do people follow? No, they don't. There's a tremendous conflict of interest, a conflict of interest between corporate interests, that is financial profit, and government bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. And any pollution, including air pollution, all of this stuff can affect your sleep patterns. If your lungs can't breathe, I mean, it's hard to sleep. In fact, I think physical wellness has been drastically affected. And now I come back to the issue of the young, for instance, again. And with the developing countries trying to keep up and outsourcing, now what's happening is the very young are being recruited in these night jobs, which are working on a Western time frame, like US or Europe. And they're making good salaries according to Indian standards, but they're not sleeping all night. And they're very young. They're living their right to life, if you want. Their living patterns have been altered. So that they're really, I would say, almost being, there's a disconnect between the Indian environment, the Indian society, and a generation of young who is living in an artificial time frame.
Exactly.
They're not living in according to their own society or their own context. So they're sort of being uprooted. It's not that they're being taken out of their country and put somewhere else. With the cyber revolution, time has completely changed. You could be sitting up all night on a computer and thinking you're in Hawaii when you're sitting in India. If you talk to these young people, you'll find that they're not really interested. They switch off. I mean, you may talk politics, you may talk issues, you may talk about the world, I mean, even abortion, and they're like, oh, well, you know, they're in a hole, in a bubble, exhausted, sleepless. It's a kind of an apathy. Sleep deprivation affects our creativity because evolution of any society or civilization is based on creativity. Now, if you dull the mind and its creative potential, you're going to slow growth. You're going to slow progress. Again, when I'm talking creativity, let's go to the Orwellian sci-fi world. So are we heading towards a robotization of the planet when human beings, when their creative, you know, process is dulled? Then what happens? Then they lose their powers of discrimination. Actually, development, progress, in a way, is having this backlash. And yet, we do need development, that sustainable development. You see, you can't set back the clock, really. I mean, it's hard to go back there.
But maybe there's a different direction to go forward.
Well, yes, that is the main issue.
Gosh, thank you so much. You've had so many interesting ideas, fantastic perspectives on society and sleep deprivation.
Take environmentalism and you take globalization. T.S. Eliot wrote way back in The Wasteland, between the idea and the reality falleth the shadow.
That is beautifully said. Well said.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Din din da takita tetete katagadi gene tatrigre tetete katagadi gene ta ta takita tati ta takita tati ta takita tati.
Ms. Jyoti Mahendru is a manager at a call center in New Delhi. She was kind enough to share with us by phone how working in this setting has changed her life and health.
Or how would you say your health is?
Very much suffering from chronic fatigueness and perpetually drowsy.
Do you actually have a diagnosis of chronic fatigue syndrome, or are you just constantly tired?
No, I'm constantly tired. Maybe this is more so because of my job. It is so that I'm constantly tired, feeling drowsy all the time. Don't feel like socializing too much. Just stick to myself.
You said that you think it's mostly because of your job. Can you explain?
Well, you see, I'm working in a BPO.
What does that mean, a BPO?
It's an outsourcing agency which gets jobs from different countries, and we handle those clients at the night. So my shifts are late at night.
What does BPO stand for?
Business Process Outsourcing.
What are your hours of work?
Generally, all the shifts which are US-based, they all start around about 6 in the evening and they finish around about 12:30 in the afternoon next day.
That is a very long shift.
Absolutely.
Is that including your commute time?
No, that's excluding my commute time. I'm giving around about 12 hours.
Wait a minute. So what time do you leave your home?
If you calculate that, it takes me 1 hour to and fro, so it's another 2 hours.
So you leave your home around 5 o'clock in the evening?
Around about 4:30, yep.
4:30, and you get to work at 5:30,
mm-hmm.
And you start your shift at 6.
Yep.
What time does your shift finish in the morning?
My first shift is finishing around about 5:36.
And so then 5:30 or 6, and then you get home by 7:30 or so?
Absolutely.
When do you actually sleep?
Give me another 2.5 hours or 3 hours. Because the moment you reach, you don't feel like sleeping because you're too exhausted, too tired. You know, you're wanting to have a little bit of respite after doing so much of job. So
sure.
Invariably, I take my dogs out for a walk. That's my only entertainment. Then I go off to sleep.
So maybe you go to sleep around 10 a.m. or something?
Around about 9:30.
Then what time would you wake up?
I get up around about 1:30, 2 o'clock because then I take care of my dogs and then get ready to leave for work.
So maybe from 9:30 to 1:30 or 2.
Yep.
That is a total of 4 or 5 hours maybe maximum?
You bet.
Is that sufficient for you?
Not at all. Not at all. That's the reason why invariably you feel exhausted, tired, and weekend off does not compensate for those many hours of sleeplessness.
You would say that you have, as a medical problem, that you're chronically tired and sleepy. Do you have any other medical problems?
Invariably, because you are sitting all the time on the computers, not only me, most of the people do suffer from spondylosis. They have a back posture problem, you know, so back aches, neck aches, grumpiness invariably turns up. You invariably are getting into a phase of depression. You don't socialize to that extent as other people do.
Now, do you think you don't socialize because you're depressed or you don't socialize because of the hours that you
tiredness.
Sleep?
Tiredness. Because you're sleeping all the time. If you are going to compromise on your sleep, then invariably what happens is when I come back, I am sleepy and groggy and tired even at office. So you have to compromise in one way, either your social life or your work.
Do you suspect that you may actually be clinically depressed?
Because of work, maybe,
mm-hmm.
But I don't think so otherwise.
I mean, it could be that because of the occupation and the lifestyle and the sleep patterns and your capacity for socializing within this structure and lifestyle, that it could be like a situational depression.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, you're right. That's the reason that you are having this problem of depression.
Do you take any medications?
No, I haven't started as yet, but I have started counseling.
Okay, good. Any medications in general on a regular basis?
Absolutely. That is for mostly for my backaches. Otherwise, no sleeping pills.
Which medication do you take for your backache?
That is homeopathy.
Oh, homeopathy. When you do sleep, how well do you sleep in terms of the quality of it?
Yeah, sometimes it's a very sound sleep, but other times it takes long to go off to actually sound sleep. What you call a sound sleep, about 2 hours, that's all. Invariably, if you are very physically and mentally tired, it does not allow you to sleep a sound sleep.
Just because you're like overtired, you're just so
absolutely
tired that you can't even relax to get to bed. Do you feel that the quality and quantity of sleep that you get impacts your health?
I think so, yes.
And would you say the quality and quantity of sleep and your sleep pattern impacts your life?
Oh, yes, definitely, definitely. Mm-hmm. Because if you're doing a morning job, it's a very different system of working. So at the end, you know, your biological cycle, or you should say your body clock, goes by the night and day and night system. So that works better for you because then you can sleep by 10:30, 11 maximum.
Why have you chosen this occupation?
Well, I should say very common factor, money and the job satisfaction.
So you enjoy your work?
Yeah, I do enjoy my work, of course.
And it's good pay?
Absolutely, absolutely.
If you're thinking in the long term about your own health and happiness and well-being and weighing all the factors, what choices could you make in which you could prioritize your health and well-being, taking your occupation into account?
I am one person who has not been taking leave for a very long time. Yes, I can take my holidays. I can go ahead and take time off just to go ahead and cover up my sleep. But the fact is, that is not the only thing. I would look for an alternate job very soon, because in long term, you cannot work in a BPO for very long, because at the end, you have to look for a job satisfaction and plus money, plus you have to take care of your health. So in the long run, I will go for a morning job.
How long have you been at this BPO?
I have been with them since last 2 years.
What was your occupation prior?
I was in a day job and I was with newspaper, media industry.
And why did you leave that?
Basically, I was looking for a change.
Great. Well, you got it, huh?
Absolutely, I got it. So, of course, it was a drastic one.
And why haven't you taken your leave?
I have a phobia that the moment I take leave, and I go back, I may not want to go back again to the same profession. Invariably, I remember the same nightmare of being tired, being all the time constantly into a sleepy and a fatigueness. So I'm trying to avoid that.
So you just simply don't take your vacation?
Absolutely. Because I'm scared I won't be able to go back again.
Well, you might be right, but that might be the best thing for you.
Yeah, it might be the best thing, but let me find some good alternate, then I will look for that option.
So at this point in your life, your priority is your occupation primarily for the financial security.
Absolutely.
But you are thinking that for the future, you might like to change your priorities to bring your health and your sleeping and your social life to a higher priority, and which would involve changing your occupation.
Absolutely. I have to. Otherwise, how would I go ahead and work furthermore?
Right.
I don't want to go through the phase where at the end, I am not only fatigued, I lose touch with my friends. I'm left like a loner. I don't want that.
It might bring more happiness into your life also.
In the long run, you have to be in a good health to be performing for your organization.
You have to be healthy and happy to be productive.
All right. Maybe after talking to you, I might think about taking a vacation.
Fantastic. Well, I hope you enjoy your vacation, and I hope that you catch up on some rest. I look forward with great curiosity to finding out what your next occupation will be.
You bet. Okay.
Well, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me.
You're more than welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Our concluding poem, in response to Mary Oliver's poem, Why I Wake Up Early. This one titled, Why I Don't Wake Up Early. I am an 8-hour woman. Do not even try to set any alarms before I have completed my sleep. And frequent insomnia insists, you do not ask me to do anything I can't skip or be late for before noon. Besides all that, it is so cozy under my comforter. The air so nippy outside my bed. There is the cold kitchen floor to be considered before crossing, to get to the even colder toilet seat. So often there is a dream in mid-suspense I would rather return to and remember. I enjoy the feeling that every morning is a weekend morning. I can relive that youthful, carefree sense of the lack of responsibilities and duties adults heap upon themselves. Besides all that, I can listen to the chirping birds just fine from my bed while I drift back into the lovely luxury of sleeping just a little longer. Naging Now was written, edited, recorded, and produced by Dr. Jayshree Chandler. Website set up and designed, Srinivas Pakanati and Dirk Polson. Tabla and Manjira played by JC. Bass guitar by Pedro Ordonez. Drum set by Jesse Garcia. Congas by Wendy Armida. Compositions from Pandit Swapan Chaudhary. Concluding poem written by JC. Distributed by Gypsy Jays Productions. Found at gypsyjays.net. JYPSYJAYS.net. You can find us on the web at naginnow.org. NEIJINGNOW.org.